You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Thursday, July 22nd, 2021. My name is Emma Figland, in for Sam Steeter, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live, steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Van Goss, author of The First Reconstruction, Black Politics in America, From the Revolution to the Civil War. Meanwhile, Republicans block debate on the bipartisan infrastructure plan, putting the Sinema-Portman deal in the balance. Oof. Global COVID infections continue to rise, surging by 70% in a week here in the United States, with South America seeing an increase in deaths. Asian nations, including Indonesia and Bangladesh, are seeing their worst infection rise yet. Tokyo set a new six-month high in COVID cases one day before the Olympics are set to open. What a disaster. Pelosi has rejected GOP representatives Jim Banks and Jim Jordan, the two Jims, as I like to call them, not really, from the January 6th commission, both who pushed false election fraud claims but agreed to seat three other Republicans on the panel. Sad for Jim Jordan specifically. He won't get to grandstand. Biden's Justice Department has declined to seek the death penalty in seven federal cases, marking a change in approach from Trump's eagerness. Time to enshrine an end to the death penalty in law. In Iran, crippling U.S. sanctions and due to climate change, those factors are driving a severe water shortage and drought. Another reminder of how sanctions can devastate populations. And lastly, documents and messages leaked to the New York Times show Washington lobbyists are reportedly scrambling and scheming to see how they can exert control in the power vacuum in Haiti. That's some sick stuff. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. I am back from my brief hiatus yesterday. I believe Sam said on the show I had an eye infection. It's a bit better today. I mean, I don't know if I need to point it out. It's this eye, but it wasn't opening. And then, you know, I did a little bit of a hot compress, went to the doctor. This is how we're opening the show. Paid a copay to be told, just hot compress it more. So, apparently it's allergies. But, these are the kinds of things that discourage me from going to the doctor, but it shouldn't discourage you. Just that, you know.
I noticed on a stream a few days ago that my eye was swollen. My face was wonky. And, like, I'm not saying I have perfect symmetry, but it was, I could notice it. And
right.
I noticed, like, my cheek had swollen a little bit. And I didn't, this is a weird type of allergy that I was unaware happened until I started staring at my face for hours a day.
Right. Well, I mean, when one eye is closed, it's a little more obvious.
Yeah, that's
obvious.
A bit of indication. Yeah.
Yeah, and it was painful. And I ended up just compressing it a lot. And it's a lot better today, thankfully. But I'm wearing glasses to shield you all from it. I also think it might have had to do with the amount of haze that we've been seeing in New York City, Matt. And a lot of that has to do with the effects of climate change and what we're seeing in terms of the just pollution and what we're seeing nationally. We'll of course be talking a bit more about that, but let's turn to Joe Biden. Joe Biden did a town hall with CNN last night, trying to sell the infrastructure package on a national stage. It was with Don Lemon, so that's a choice. Biden came out in favor of a talking filibuster last night, which is good news, because shifting the filibuster to a talking filibuster would eliminate a lot of the problems that we're seeing in terms of Republican obstruction. That is the good news. The bad news is that he continued to echo childlike notions of Republican reasonability even though he's been alive for quite a while. Usually you're supposed to get wiser as you get older, but not in Biden's case. He's clinging to literal fairy tales about how voting rights legislation will get passed. Let's take a listen to his full answer to Don Lemon last night.
I would go back to that where you have to maintain the floor. You have to stand there and talk and hold the floor. You can't just say
I understand
now.
That. But what difference is that if you hold the floor for, you know, a day or a year? What difference does it make? Here's the thing for me. You talked about people, and this is important for people who look like me. My grandmother would sit around when I was a kid, fifth grade, had a fifth grade education. I learned that she couldn't read when I was doing my homework. She would tell me stories about people asking her to count the number of jelly beans in the jar, yep, or the soap. And so why is protecting the filibuster, is that more important than protecting voting rights, especially for people who fought and died for that?
No, it's not. I want to see the United States Congress, the United States Senate, pass S1 and S4, the John Lewis Act, get them to my desk so I can sign them. But here's the deal. What I also want to do, I want to make sure we bring along not just all the Democrats. We bring along Republicans who I know better. They know better than this. And what I don't want to do is get wrapped up right now in the argument whether or not this is all about the filibuster or look, the American public, you can't stop them from voting. You tried last time. More people voted last time than any time in American history, in the middle of the worst pandemic in American history. More people did. And they showed up. They're going to show up again. They're going to do it again. But what I want to do is I'm trying to bring the country together. And I don't want the debate to only be about whether or not we have a filibuster or exceptions to the filibuster or the going back to the way the filibuster had to be used before.
But isn't that the only way you're going to get it done right now?
No, I don't believe that. I think we can get it done.
If you.
Based on what evidence? Based on what evidence do you think that you're going to be able to get it done with Republican votes? Because, as I said at the beginning of the show, they are, despite long negotiations about this bipartisan infrastructure package, which most of the money comes from unused money anyway, they're already blocking debate on that, and that hangs in the balance, let alone a voting rights bill that would curb these statewide efforts to suppress the vote and make them more successful electorally. Because one party chooses to, through means that are completely unethical and cruel and racist, to make sure that they win elections. And the other party's like, I don't know if I'm that interested in that. Which is why Joe Biden is the president and why Biden is the leader of that party. I mean, like, the idea that Republicans know better and that he thinks he can bring Republicans along, you know, he has no evidence for that. And then when Don Lemon basically talks, well, that's the conversation is. It's about the filibuster. You have to make that the conversation. Biden's like, I don't think we do. On what planet?
This was a collaborationist statement from Joe Biden. He's collaborating with the Republicans in the statement of people will vote. What a Democrat is telling you when they say, well, people are going to vote anyway, is that we don't care if the shape of the electorate gets shaped in, say, more upwardly mobile, higher income directions, which is what voting restrictions do. They hurt people of lower income. That's why Republicans love to do it, and that's why Democrats apparently are ambivalent about it as long as they get enough people to turn out from the suburbs.
Well, that's true. But, of course, it's short-sighted in the way that they're looking at it, because much like their courting of these suburban voters is short-sighted, they are interested in short-term success for themselves, but in the long term, they have to build a working-class coalition. They cannot continue to skate along on anti-Trump resentment from upper-class to upper-middle-class suburbanites. But they care mostly about the amount of money that's coming into their coffers from those specific donors. Eventually, people are going to get less outrage and they're going to turn to alternatives. They're not going to have a hold of the professional managerial class, to use an overused phrase, forever, unless they broaden their coalition. So a lot of what it is arrogance. You're right. So I am encouraged by the talking filibuster element, but mostly discouraged by the rest of that answer. Because, once again, you can't defeat your opponent. One, if you don't consider them your opponent. It's like the Steelers and the Packers playing, and the Steelers are like, I kind of like a lot of these Packers players. I kind of think they're not trying to actually hit me.
Yeah. Get it done.
We're buddies.
Malarkey.
Yeah. You have to identify your opponent so you can defeat your opponent. And Biden doesn't even see them as an opponent. So, wakey wakey, at least he's on board with, all right, we won't fully eliminate the filibuster. But if he can't make that a reality if he doesn't first understand what he's up against.
But it's like, I could make that decision, I would say, yeah, do it. But it's like, this is only in service of, you know, passing things like the PRO Act, or which, I mean, we could get some of the reconciliation, but like, or these voting rights stuff, like, just have to do it. And Lemon's point of like, is this process stuff more important? And he goes into all this stuff about how he believes in the process. It's like, nobody else does, Joe.
Yeah, nobody does, but I'm going to yes and you again, but except for the people that he surrounds himself with, and that very much colors his perspective on leadership, just given how long he's been in Washington for that long. It's very discouraging. But again, if we're trying to look towards a path forward with the filibuster, he seems to be signaling that at least there's a conversation to be had about the talking filibuster, and maybe they think they can move Manchin on that. Maybe that's what Klobuchar was signaling the other day. So we've got to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be joined by Van Goss, and we have a great discussion ahead of us. All right, I'd like to welcome to the program Van Goss, professor of history at Franklin and Marshall College and author of The First Reconstruction, Black Politics in America, From the Revolution to the Civil War. Van, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Oh, thank you.
So your book, it logs black political action and organization in the pre-Civil War days in this country. And so much of our learned history in the United States just excludes black participation in the political process, even right, after the Civil War, but particularly in the pre-Civil War era. So talk about, I just give us a broad sense of the political organization that achieved abolition in pockets of this country in the pre-Civil War era that largely gets looked over. And we can just start there. What is the First Reconstruction?
Well, it's a deliberately provocative title, because Reconstruction, as properly named, is the policy of the U.S. government from 1863 to 1877 to reconstruct the rebel states and bring them back into the Union. And at the center of that process is what will the 4 million formerly enslaved people do, and what will the government do for them, with them, against them? So that's, you know, that's how we understand Reconstruction. But I am one of various historians, I'm not the only one, who said, well, Reconstruction comes after emancipation. That is actually the process, emancipation and Reconstruction. There was emancipation already in the United States, starting during the Revolution. Multiple forms of emancipation. The British Army emancipated, if memory serves, about 30,000, by far the biggest. Multiple states considered, legislated, or by judicial action, emancipated significant numbers of enslaved people of African descent during and immediately after the Revolution, and then actually extending the 19th century. New York State, which had a very significant enslaved population, only finished emancipation in 1827. So the premise of my book is, if there was emancipation, there was also Reconstruction. Those people didn't disappear. They didn't get on boats and allow some whites to send them back to Africa. They merged into the larger society, which was always multiracial. So I'm saying, you know, emancipation and Reconstruction begin much earlier. And we need to pay attention to those processes as in fact, continuous, not as a something back during the Revolution and then radical Reconstruction in 1866, say. It's a continuous process from the 1770s really on. So that's why I call the book The First Reconstruction, is to say, you know, if you want, there's a kind of a rehearsal for Reconstruction in places from Maine to New Jersey to Ohio. And it takes extremely different forms, all of which kind of anticipates what's going to happen during and after radical Reconstruction in the 1860s and 70s. In some places, it's quite radical in parts of the North from the 1780s on. In other places, it effectively creates a Jim Crow states in parts of the North, especially the Midwest. So I think that's a good way of jumping into the book.
Absolutely. And, you know, I'm just curious about your thoughts about what accounts for the erasure of these kinds of political movements. Is it because it's purely not on a federal level? Or is it also because it doesn't center white people in the way that I think a lot of our Civil War history chooses to do?
Yeah, well, certainly, you just said it. I mean, so much of the history of this period from the Revolution, the Civil War, it focused in my upbringing entirely on white people. I didn't even know, as a young man deeply interested in history, a boy, a teenager, I didn't know there were any free people of color in the North. It was never taught in any way, shape, or form. So that's been a long process of rediscovering. Black historians and indeed African Americans always knew about this history. They knew about it, but they were ignored by historians. So there's been a process of rediscovering the history of the free people of color, the formerly enslaved people, and some who had never been enslaved in the northern states. For reasons that are in some ways hard to fathom, getting at their political activism has come at the very end. So when I started writing this book about 2004, and it was almost by accident, this is not the book I thought I was going to write, because I didn't know anything about this either. I just had a few trace references here and there, and it got bigger and bigger. You know, I realized there was more and more, and then I needed to tell that story. But there's a second point to this, besides the centering of white people and the exclusion of anyone else. I think that across the political spectrum, interestingly, including quite far on the left, which is where I am, there is a shibboleth about the nature of electoral democracy or just electoral politics in the U.S. So I'm going to state what it is. And I could easily go and look in, I don't know, The Nation magazine or The Progressive or In These Times or some other, or and find some good, decent, well-educated progressive person saying, watch my lips. At the founding of the United States, only propertied white men voted. That is, for all I know, that could be in some AP exam, which would be really bad. No part of that statement is accurate. Only propertied white men voted. None of it that's accurate. There were places in the early United States where only propertied white men voted. So let's start. Only men. Nope. Women voted in New Jersey. Black women voted even in New Jersey from 1776 to 1807. And this was not some kind of accident. They knew what they were doing. It was discussed. Parties actually tried to get the women's vote. And on occasion, there would be some charge that, two, I'm going to use the language of the time. I hope nobody's offended. Two colored women, you know, decided a state Senate election. So first, the idea that women, think about this, that it was perfectly natural that only men voted. Well, not in New Jersey, which was by no means the smallest of the original colonies and states. They knew what they were doing. There, you had to be an independent woman, meaning a woman who owned some property, was not married, was widowed, and there were plenty of them. So that we deal with that. Then the property thing. No, in at least five states, and at least five, including Massachusetts and Pennsylvania, you had, from the end of the Revolution on, effectively taxpayer suffrage. Taxpayer suffrage is not the same at all as a property requirement. And My hero, if you want, one of my heroes, Thaddeus Stevens, the greatest revolutionary in American history. Yes, I said that. The hard man of Reconstruction. Thaddeus Stevens, when they were debating suffrage in 1837 in the Pennsylvania Constitutional Convention, said, everybody here knows that any man who can scrape together a quarter of a dollar can vote in this state. So it was a extremely minimal poll tax that it basically excluded paupers, which is a category they used to care about a lot. They didn't want paupers voting. That's five states at the founding. And then we get to my history. In 10 of the original 13, there was no racial bar to suffrage. 10 of the 13. Only three of the big southern states with big enslaved populations put white into their suffrage requirements. How do we know this? When the Dred Scott decision was announced, the most horrific judicial decision in American history, everyone who paid attention knew that this was really bad law. When Justice Taney, Chief Justice Taney, that's how you pronounce his name, said that Africans had never been, never could be, were never recognized as citizens of the United States. He stated this as a fact. This was extraordinarily bad law. And Justice Curtis, in his dissent, pointed out, and Justice Curtis, you know, he didn't have access to the web the way we do. He said what he knew. He said in his dissent that in five of the 13, he was incorrect, it was 10. In five of the 13, men of African descent had voted freely alongside white men. Guess who quoted Justice Curtis's dissent within weeks at a speech in Illinois? Abraham Lincoln.
Wow.
So if Abraham Lincoln, as any well-trained lawyer, knew this, that black men had been voting at the founding, and Lincoln's point was, and I use this quote in the book, it wasn't just that they were voting, they voted to ratify the Constitution. Well, there is no more weighty vote in the history of this country than to vote in the ratification elections of the Constitution. So notice, only propertied white men could vote. If you get that wrong, if you think that there were, you know, all of these bars, no women, no black men, no men of color, no men without property. If you start from that assumption, it's pretty easy to leave out black voting because it's just part of everybody else that's left out, except it's just not accurate.
Well, I mean, it is, I think, part and parcel of an erasure that we're talking about here. And what your book does is, I think, really accurately and fascinatingly kind of recapture by looking at this era in the 19th century, but more specifically of these different pockets in the United States that had this burgeoning section of political activism. I guess let's start with New England, because maybe chronologically that makes the most sense.
Yes.
You call it the non-racial Yankee Republic in New Hampshire, Massachusetts, other states, Maine, Vermont as well. So talk about the history there. The beginning of the first Reconstruction.
So historians, at least the kind of historian I am, we have a lot of leeway to sort of say we're going to shape this history because we're telling a story. Otherwise, it's just an infinite, literally infinite number of facts that pile up. And that's boring, at least it is to me. So I basically said, you know what, let's divide New England. Upper New England, lower New England. Upper is Massachusetts and points north, keeping in mind that Maine was part of Massachusetts until 1820. This is one of the most, and it's really important for me to stress this. Nowadays, those states, once you get above Massachusetts, those states collectively have, last time I looked, five members of Congress. Five out of 435. They're tiny little states. They're quaint, you know? It's where Bernie's from and lobsters. This was not the case after the Revolution. Vermont, New Hampshire, Maine were boom states filling up with people, with at one point, I used, I think, 1820 as a measuring point, nine times as many members of Congress, something like that. So they really counted. Those states emancipated totally, not gradually, New York, Pennsylvania, Connecticut. New Jersey's the worst. New Jersey, it's so gradual, it's a little hard to tell that slavery ever disappears until after the Civil War. Very gradual, apprentice programs. In Massachusetts and points north, it wasn't gradual. It was by judicial decision that simply slavery could no longer exist. And these were in judicial cases brought by black people. They went to court to say, this man came over and beat me up and tried to drag me back to his house. I'm filing a case for assault. That's Mum Bett, the Elizabeth Freeman case. These were very famous. There's nothing obscure about them. So they had a more radical emancipation. And in tandem with that, non-racial suffrage and Black men entering very quickly into politics. So by the late 1780s, prominent Massachusetts figures are saying, oh, there, look at Prince Hall. Prince Hall, founder of the Black Masonic Lodge, a very famous man in his day. Look at Prince Hall leading his men to the polls. He votes. So there in that upper New England, there is never any attempt to disfranchise. It is not on the table. Both parties compete for votes very actively, though the Federalists, for lots of reasons that are, you know, if too detailed, read the book if you want. The Federalists generally get the Black votes, in part because the Federalists are what used to be called the Saltwater Party, the party of trade and international commerce, and an extremely high percentage of Black men in New England are sailors or otherwise involved in maritime. They work on the docks. They have a distinct labor orientation. So they have a class interest in Uwant if allying with wealthy Federalists. They work with them. So that's upper New England, where Black voting comes in extremely early, is very public. Their votes are contested, and they just keep mostly, essentially, in places like Portland, Salem, Newburyport, Boston, they just keep going up, getting more and more influence until they kind of plateau in the 1850s. And some patronage positions, I'll wrap this up so you can see. For me, you know, are they getting offices in the parties? I don't mean high-level office. Are they going to ward committees? Are they being listed in the newspapers as part of the poll workers? Or and are they getting patronage? And some people maybe think this is irrelevant. No, it's not, actually. If you're excluded from the patronage, then you're disrespected, and it means you don't have much influence. Conversely, if you get some patronage, it means that your influence is respected. And I am able to demonstrate that across upper New England, they get some patronage, they get some party offices, and in some cases, in the more radical third parties, they get a lot of party offices in the Liberty and Free Soil parties. Well, so that's upper. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, you detail a judicial fight which pushed a lot of this forward, but there was also a rich history of Black electoralism in these regions as well. Talk a little bit more about those coalitions formed, whether it be with the Whigs later on, and, you know, eventually, of course, settling on the Republican Party more nationally. But just how that came to be, and how those organizations formed.
Well, I have a theory. Okay.
Okay.
Especially about New England. Well, some of it's based in just a lot of evidence, but it's also a thesis. In New England, especially throughout the North, but especially in New England, there is what my friend and a great scholar, David Waldstreicher, calls sectional nationalism. There is a New England nationalism, which is deeply and frankly anti-Southern. And this goes back to the 1790s and the frankly quite justified perception that the Southerners had thrown their weight around, first at the Constitutional Convention and then in Congress, to get what they wanted. And to push national policy in their own interests. And once, of course, Jefferson wins in 1800, beating a Massachusetts man, John Adams, and then you have 24 straight years of Virginia presidents, sectional nationalism takes off. New England nationalism, anti-Southern, is almost perforce anti-slavery. And this can be a very practical look at, you know, contempt for them. They call themselves small R Republicans, but they own human beings. They're a bunch of hypocrites.
Right.
Or it can be more actually ideologically motivated. It's very hard to sort out the self-interest, the Schadenfreude, if you want, Schadenfreude, and the actual ideological conviction. So what that means is there's plenty of votes in New England, whether in 1800 or in 1860, there are plenty of votes in opposing slavery and opposing the South. Who's going to get those votes? That's the question. Here's my thesis. I think there's what I would call a demonstration effect. If Black men, and voting is extremely public, you can see what color paper someone is putting into the ballot box. You can see which ballot they took from which party worker. If Black men vote for the Whigs, in the 1830s and 40s. It's a signal that in New England, the Whigs are anti-slavery. If black men turn away from the Whigs and vote for the Liberty Party, which is a radical anti-slavery party, it's a different signal. So black men, even quite small numbers of them, are fought over. Who is the signal being sent to? The much larger number of white men who are trying to decide whether to vote for a major party that is running slave owners, slaveholders for president, but is a major party, or to vote for a third party, throw away their vote, so to speak. I hope this is the logic of this is making sense. So when they see, if a black man says, I'm voting, I'm a true Whig, I'm sticking with the Whigs because this is my party. And I have a great deal of evidence showing this. This sends a message to white men, it's okay to vote for the Whigs, because at least in the North, the Whigs are good anti-slavery men. Conversely, if black men switch over to the Free Soilers in 1848, then that's a message of, okay, we can switch too. So that is what elevates the importance of the black vote, besides the fact that in these port towns, Portland, New Bedford's my best example, there are enough of them to really count. New Bedford is a whole chapter in the book. I refer to it, as many people did at the time, as the apex of black power. They called it the Gibraltar of, and then these were Democrats, then they use a really ugly word that I'm not going to quote. So the Gibraltar, the great fortress, there were hundreds and hundreds of black men actively voting in New Bedford. And they really, they put it right out there. They questioned candidates. They ran their own slates. They told their voters how to vote. It was very, very clear they were throwing their weight around. Wait, let me just fill in the background so you understand. New Bedford in this period, 1830s, 40s, 50s, is the richest place in America. It is fabulously rich because of the whaling trade. And black men are deeply involved in that trade at every level on the ships. Some of them are officers. So they are economically empowered, they are politically empowered, and their vote, shifting their vote from the Whigs to the Liberty Party or to the Free Soil Party, is, it actually, in some ways, almost reverberates nationally. People know about this across the country.
Wow. Yeah, and I want to move, because there's so many other sections in your sure. book, to Pennsylvania, which is another place yeah. in which there were black people who achieved a significant amount of power, and it had a bit of a different effect, right? Because it, at least in Philadelphia, resulted in the formation of a black elite, which ran counter in some instances, as you write, to the interests of the larger black population in that area. So talk a bit about that, because that's a really another fascinating wrinkle to our history here.
Yes. Philadelphia is in many ways the center of free black life in the North. It is the largest community and the wealthiest. It is in 1828, a very prominent black minister and newspaper editor, Samuel Cornish, who had come from Philadelphia to New York to publish the first black newspaper, Freedom's Journal. He wrote this article that I cite, lots of people have cited it actually. He says, well, this is the elite of our people. Look at their churches. These are really elegant churches. But then he also goes on to say, and they love politics. They love it. They love politicking with each other inside their churches. So the Philadelphia elite, who were nationally and even internationally famous, James Fortin, the gentleman of color, who was a very prominent sailmaker and merchant, was known on both sides of the Atlantic and socialized with, I mean, the Philadelphia elite are very, very wealthy, rich people at the center of a huge transnational merchant trade. So they're very connected, James Fortin, for instance, or Bishop Richard Allen. But for complicated reasons, they choose not to vote. They don't vote, and they don't mobilize their voters. So this huge, prosperous, free black community consciously abstains from voting for decades in Philadelphia. And I trace that history. There are good reasons for it. They are on the border of slave states, Delaware and Maryland. They urgently need like a really high level of protection. And the evidence strongly suggests that their white allies, basically, to put it, pretty much the entire leadership of the Philadelphia bar, at a time when the bar, the lawyers, you know, the bar of Philadelphia was the most important in the country, the evidence strongly suggests that they said, we'll protect you. We'll make sure that the state legislature doesn't require you to carry certificates. Acts against kidnapping, because there are a lot of kidnappers coming into Philadelphia, but don't vote. If you vote, there's going to be a lot of trouble. Don't vote. And they go along with that for decades. So that's Philadelphia. And this has been studied by other people. This is what happened. They chose not to vote. They were not chased from the polls by violence. They chose not to. They accepted being left off the tax rolls, which function as the voter registration rolls. What I was able to find out, investigate, and I'm obviously somewhat proud of this, is that Black men were voting across the rest of Pennsylvania, where the majority of African Americans lived. The majority of African Americans in Pennsylvania didn't live in Philadelphia. They lived in counties all around Pennsylvania, like the ones that I grew up in, like Bucks County, Lancaster County, Washington County, Allegheny County, big ones. They voted in those counties for 40 or 50 years until disfranchisement in 1837-38. And there's a very rich history in some of these big, prosperous counties of Black men being organized groups of voters, just as in New England. But then they are disfranchised. That's the difference in Pennsylvania.
And it got to that point. You know, how did I guess, you know, a lot of, was there a bit of a backlash or some sort of coalescing that made things harder for Black people? You know, of course, it's on a state by state basis, but in terms of what, voter intimidation and segregation to extreme extents, of course, it was, I'm sure, would imagine, always fairly segregated. I mean, what was the bit of the backlash that many of these...
Why disfranchisement? Is that what you're at?
Yes, and that too. In Pennsylvania.
I believe in general, I mean, there's lots of disfranchisement, and this is what most historians, I mean, they would put in the textbooks, they would say, basically, there would be a paragraph saying, oh, across the North, Black men were disfranchised, which begs the question of, well, but they were voting before that.
Right.
It's like, well, what about when they were voting? And I might be setting up a straw man or tilting at a windmill here. I think there has been an implicit presumption that this disfranchisement was a kind of natural form of erasure, to use your word, that it just kind of came on naturally, and that it came out of racism. They got around to noticing Black men. Well, of course they disfranchised them. I don't think that's actually accurate, because there was plenty of racism all along, and yet they kept voting. Disfranchisement in Pennsylvania, in states like New York, where it took place, was a product of intense partisan conflict. In the mid-1830s, a coalition of Whigs and anti-Masons, the anti-Masonic party, I'm not going to get into that, and very important party, kind of populistic, anti-elite party that Thaddeus Stevens was a leader of, finally really has a chance to take over the state against the traditional Democrats, the Jeffersonian Republicans turned Jackson Democrats. And you get into the state is shifting back and forth. The Whigs and anti-Masons, especially the anti-Masons in Pennsylvania, were extremely anti-slavery. They were openly. Thaddeus Stevens helped elect the governor, Simon Rittner, who gave his speech in 1835 saying, we will no longer bow our dark knee to slavery. So in that context, the Democrats are the party of white supremacy for most of their history. The Democrats figured one way they could counterattack was by whipping up sentiment about Black voting. And they found several elections. They set up a target and went after it. This ought to sound very familiar to your listeners.
Right.
I mean, this is for partisan reasons. You invent cases. And they managed to turn, there were a lot of Black men voting in parts of Bucks County, which is the sixth largest county in Pennsylvania then. Yeah. And they've been voting for a long time.
Familiar county to our listeners too.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So they make a big case of that. There was a prosperous Black farmer, a man named William Fogg, up in Luzerne County, way up there, traditionally more anti-slavery. And, some Democratic judges simply barred him from voting, which from what one can tell, he was a property. And, he had every reason to vote. He's probably been voting for years. So he goes to the state Supreme Court. So they picked a fight and managed to make Black voting something they could rally white men around, and they got rid of it. So, and that's the story in all of these cases of disfranchisement. It's a way to rally white men for a particular party. So that's Pennsylvania.
Yes. And then you also mentioned New York, where before, you know, we run out of time, I want to talk about New York because of the incredible amount of black influence there. You basically, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but seem to posture that it was the most influential black voting bloc in the country, or something to that effect. There was an incredible story about how spooked Martin Van Buren got about black enfranchisement. Talk a little bit about that. Take us through that history in the early 19th century.
Well, I'll try to do it very briefly.
No, it doesn't need to be brief. No,
New York, greater New York City. New York City then was just New York County, Manhattan. The five boroughs that are today New York City, meaning all of eastern Long Island, the counties up the Hudson, and even the northeastern counties in New Jersey, is one of the largest slave operating, enslaved labor using places in the country. Most of the Dutch farmers, whether in Brooklyn or what is today Bergen County, what is today Nassau County, what is today Ulster, all of those counties, at one point or another, this is not my work, this is the work of a terrific historian named Craig Stephen Wilder. Those Dutch farmers, and they're a very powerful ethnic class interest, they either bought or hired enslaved labor for their big farms. So there were lots of black men all over that region, many of whom claimed freedom during the revolution when the British came in. And, you know, there are several decades there where the best thing, to put it in kind of the best thing an enslaved person could see is, you know, a British ship in the harbor, because that means that you have a chance at freedom. And that was true during the War of 1812. So right up through, you know, Washington marches into New York finally in 1783, the British general refusing to give him back his property, they watched the British ships leave with thousands of formerly enslaved people. So, but there are thousands left there. And so there's the basis for an extremely active and militant politics, because the British had actually, in many ways, liberated them. A lot of black men had been guerrilla fighters for the British, occupying the blockhouses on the Hudson. So they've got a lot of numbers, and they're fired up. They're not like the Philadelphians. They're not cautious. They're a fired up constituency. They start voting really early, even though there's still 4,000 enslaved people in 1827. Sojourner Truth was born a slave in 1814 up the Hudson. So you've got all these enslaved people, and then all these people who bought their freedom or run away and change their name. So it's a very dynamic environment. And by the early 1800s, they are in New York City and in Brooklyn, what is today Brooklyn, a pretty mobilized constituency. They control certain trades, notably chimney sweeping, which is a dirty, dangerous job. And they use small children. It's pretty exploitative. And they are being courted by both parties. And they reach a peak of influence in sort of 1810, 1813, when black men in New York have enough votes to swing the entire city's assembly delegation. This is a complicated story, but it's really something. And if you swing the New York City Assembly delegation, you could control the whole assembly. And if you control the assembly, you're pretty close to controlling the entire patronage pot of New York, 15,000 jobs. The assembly will name every officer in the state. The mayor of New York City will be named by the state legislator. That's 15,000 jobs at a time when the entire federal patronage pool is 3,000. So this is big time politics, and the black vote's really crucial. So once again, what will later be Democrats, Martin Van Buren's bucktail Republicans, which are really the basis for the National Democratic Party in the 1820s, they mobilized to get rid of this big, empowered black vote. It's a hard fought. It takes 10 years, 1811, 1821. And they finally succeed in passing a huge, high property requirement for black men. You couldn't just be well off. You couldn't be a professional. You had to own land, a freehold worth $250. That's a big, big farm.
Right.
1821. So it was effectively completely disfranchising, but with a little fig leaf. The second part of my chapters on New York, though, which I think is, I'm building on some work that other people did, but I have a lot of, you know, look at the census. By the late 1850s, through a whole variety of maneuvers and techniques, the black electorate has rebuilt itself, and they are claiming 11,000 votes in New York State. Now, New York State is a huge electorate, hundreds and hundreds of thousands, but it's enough to count. And they have become an organized submachine wing of the Republican Party in the later 1850s. And this has taken 20 years of work and a concentration of leadership unlike anywhere else in the country. This is why Douglas went to New York, went to Rochester, because he wanted to be where the action was. They've got Douglas, Henry Highland Garnett, Samuel Ringel Ward, and then you could another 15 or 20 top leaders all in New York State, all deeply tied into partisan politics. So that's kind of, in some ways, the center of the book. I call it the New York battleground.
And then, I mean, that's kind of where the Republican Party seems to coalesce in this area, and the separate parties that had been vying for black votes and black liberation from more radical perspectives, right. They kind of fell by the wayside a little bit. I wanted to ask a broader question about our history and what this says about the nature of progress, because so much of this, you know, you see things progress, things regress, they're regional, they take decades, there are different iterations of it that lack success but have good intentions, and then additionally how this progress is completely washed over in our historical context. I mean, like, I think of, this is such a silly example, but it's like the Mississippi burning effect, right? Where now, you know, the FBI was the one who really the KKK.
Yeah.
The white Union soldiers are the ones responsible for black liberation. Like, yeah. I mean, how much of that is, you know, what's your take on that, really?
Well, I mean, I think over the past, well, really since Obama's election, I think that I myself have had to reconsider I would not have said that I'm attached to a narrative of progress, but I probably was, you know, naively, and because of my subject position, which is, you know, look at me, right? I think what was done to Obama, the rise of a vicious white nationalist politics to block everything, and the inability of the Democratic Party, which he had to do anything about that. And then, of course, Trump. I think American historians should just completely dispense with any notion of progress. And I do not mean, however, I want to be clear, I do not mean that we should substitute for a notion of progress, a liberal notion, a Whig history of getting better all the time, that we should substitute a dystopian always was just this way. I'm not going with either one of those. I think we just have to accept that American history, whatever that means, the history of the United States, has always been a history of intense conflict that is unresolved. Eric Foner called Reconstruction America's unfinished revolution. I think the revolution itself was, to say the least, unfinished. Reconstruction was unfinished, and here we are. And so we have to accept and enter into the constancy, the permanency of this struggle, and that it is, in fact, at the level of cities and states, that we cannot also, we have to be very wary of single national narratives, those mostly obscure realities. We have to get down into the nitty gritty and down into the weeds. And if we do that, we say, oh, well, I mean, here's this struggle that was successful for a while. And, you know, but success always breeds more problems. Any political success, actual political success, the second Reconstruction, civil rights movement of the 50s, 60s, 70s, sure, it ended Jim Crow, formal Jim Crow. It, for the first time in 1868, the majority of African American people could vote. And here we are now. That was a success, right? We go from 100 black elected officials in 1964 to 24,000 now, right? That's a great success, but look where we are. You know that you can't. We can't have any happy tales. So for me, give up on progress, but also do not succumb to the idea that there is no real history, that it's always just existing. You know, the same all the way through. It's not the same all the way through. History is based. There will be change. What kind of change is the question?
Right. Well. Wise words, Van Goss, professor of history at Franklin Marshall College, and your book is called The First Reconstruction, Black Politics in America, from Revolution to the Civil War. Thank you so much, Van, for your time today.
Thank you very much.
All right, folks, as Sam might say, quick break and we will be right back. I thought that was quite excellent, really fascinating.
I think that view of history is very important. There are a lot of crappy and obviously reactionary motivated critiques of the 1619 Project, but one that Adolf Reed makes, which is that when you call people who were indentured just slaves, you're collapsing a lot of history there, and in a way you obscure the fact that things can regress and actually like gains can be lost, and actually like a giant racial project like white supremacy can really get its steam going in like the middle of after a lot of the time that Goss was talking about. So I think that type of history is really important. Like William Wells Brown, a lot of people don't know, he's the first African-American writer in fiction, published fiction novelist, wrote Clotel. His father fought in the American Revolutionary War, and then William Wells Brown, when he was a writer, had to go to Europe because of fugitive slave acts, right? So like this like history is not linear. There's not a linear progress narrative. There isn't.
Right. Let's before we go talk about Ron DeSantis. So Ron DeSantis was recently selling on his website "Don't Fauci My Florida" merch, is now imploring people to get the vaccine as the Delta variant spreads like wildfire. Global cases are up around 12%, and less vaccinated states are seeing an alarming rise in cases and deaths. And everywhere's really seeing a rise in cases, but specifically more dangerously in states that have less vaccination. So let's take a listen to what he has to say, because I think he's kind of doing a Mitch McConnell pivot here a bit.
So here's, I think, the most important thing with the data. If you are vaccinated, fully vaccinated, the chance of you getting seriously ill or dying from COVID is effectively zero. If you look at the people that are being admitted to hospitals, over 95% of them are either not fully vaccinated or not vaccinated at all. And so these vaccines are saving lives. They are reducing mortality. Mortality in nursing homes since we rolled out the vaccines in December is down over 95% due to COVID. Mortality for elderly people since we rolled out the vaccines is down nearly 90%. And so we're proud in Florida that we put seniors first on that because they were the most vulnerable. We have 85% of our seniors that are vaccinated and about 75% of folks over the age of 50. We have no mandate. We've provided information to people, and we've been very honest about any data that comes out. And I can tell you that if you look, you are seeing people that are vaccinated. For whatever reason, some, I think, can test positive if you're vaccinated. But they don't get seriously ill, except maybe rare instances. There's always one-offs on stuff. But I can tell you in Florida...
Yeah, I mean, that's basically the gist of it. He did a complete 180 on vaccines, and it seems like it's a bit of a coordinated effort. We had Mitch McConnell, who came out and essentially said, I don't understand why nobody's getting vaccinated. It's only members of my own party who... who are telling people it's going to kill you. And now we're seeing Sean Hannity and right-wing media that's all coming out in favor of vaccines. And that's because, say it with me, this new surge is threatening the economy and capital. And we've seen a ton of freakouts about the stock market and collapsing in that area. And that's the only thing that guys like this respond to. But, you know, we're going to... Did someone want to say something?
And specifically their voting base. And, you know, elections aren't decided by that much. Maybe Ron DeSantis will be okay. But, you know, he's got an election coming up and it's his voters that are vulnerable right now, not Democratic voters.
Yes, exactly. And also... To that point, though, he is taking a bit of a gamble because DeSantis, of all of these prospective 2024 candidates who wanted to be Trump light, he's been the most successful at it. And they, Tucker Carlson, right-wing media, everybody online has so thoroughly gotten their base to believe that vaccines are in some way caving to the liberal media. And again, I'm not trying to make this like a culture war thing, but this is just the reality of what this Republican project is, that maybe him even saying this, being a responsible governor for his state might hurt him in his presidential election.
Yeah, well, Noam from South Dakota is hitting him on it because the Dakotas are a lot more insulated from this stuff. They aren't seeing a rise yet. That's because typically it takes a little bit longer for things to get to North Dakota.
Right. I mean, there are literally people running against Greg Abbott from the right. I think it's Alan West. Because he locked down for a little bit. And so soon enough for this Republican base, DeSantis is going to be too far left on COVID response because he said vaccines work.
Well, so yeah, you hear DeSantis trying to get ahead of that by saying, you know, we did it all voluntarily. Well, it's like the truth is, guy, that you are in the middle of the pack as far as states go in terms of vaccination rate, and you are at the top of the pack in terms of at-risk populations because of the nature of Florida.
Right.
So you have a serious problem in the way that, like, again, like I said, like Noam, she has a luxury because until like Sturgis comes around again and they start up another wave that way, it's kind of quiet out there.
All right, guys, we got to say goodbye to our Peacock audience. Sayonara. See you tomorrow. And if you are hanging around with us, we've got more to talk about. I mean, just reflecting on Van Gosse's contributions to the show there. Like, as you were saying, Matt, narratives that envelop history, even if they're, you know, ostensibly ones that are meant to kind of lionizing progress in and of itself is not a good thing. Because it obscures the work that it takes. I mean, we see this with Martin Luther King on a daily basis.
English plantation masters in like the Caribbean and the South literally like had this what was called like the black legend against Spanish slavers that they were so much worse. So like all the guys that were running like cane sugar plantations in the Caribbean thought that they were actually like, oh, we're dealing them a little bit better, even though we're, you know, killing them at like a like after like 5 years of this work, right? They thought, well, the Spanish were worse. So like these linear progress narratives are harmful because they're basically like apologies for the current status quo. Because if the past was so bad, I think the message that a layman will get, well, it's like, well, this is now I'm not, you know, I'm not enslaved now, for instance, right? Like,
or I'm a passenger in my own history,
right?
Which is dangerous in and of itself. It's depoliticizing, or it's, you know, it doesn't allow for agency for people in their current lived experience politically. So, all right, folks, we're going to head into the fun half. Do we have Brandon? Do we have old Matt?
Old Matt should be joining us briefly.
I'm not seeing him.
Brandon yet.
But first, what's happening on Left Reckoning tonight?
So actually, it was last night.
Last night.
8 Eastern, Wednesday is our new time. Lillian Chichurkia, I believe I'm pronouncing that right, on post-Marxism and why it's wrong, why being post-Marxist is bad. She talked with David Griscom about that. And we also, what else did we do last night? We talked about Bezos and Branson a little bit, and especially in the context of the awful treatment that Frito-Lay workers are standing up against. So check that out last night. We had a lot of fun in the post game too. We also talked about the posthumous article released by Jacobin, written by Michael, about the war on poverty. And I think David Griscom probably knows Michael's mind as well as anybody on that particular issue, and like going public with it and just the gross way that like Trump's attack on food stamps was covered by, you know, people who never dealt with anything remotely like that. So check that out last night, patreon.com/leftreckoning to get the post game.
Hello, Matt Binder.
Hi, Emma. Hi, Matt. How are you guys all doing?
Now we have Brandon. How are you? What's happening on Doom?
Oh, hey, Brandon's here too. Well, tonight, youtube.com/Matt Binder. I will be talking with an organizer with No Olympics, LA. We'll be discussing all the various problems with the Olympic Games and what they do to their host cities. And specifically, we'll be talking about the issues with what's going on this year at the Tokyo Games, and then what they're trying to do to stop the upcoming games in coming here in a few years. That's tonight, youtube.com/Matt Binder.
Awesome. Brandon, what's happening at the discourse? What's up?
Well, I'm in the process of editing our latest episode on COVID-19 and the current crisis or manufactured crisis, or, you know, happening.
Totally get it.
You know, that's always happening, but specifically in this case, referring to Cuba. And I'm going to be working on that. And that should be out, you know, soon for our fans and haters alike.
All right. Well, fans and haters, please hit the like button and subscribe. I was just reminded by a dear person in our chat to do that, which I just did. So 646-257-3920. Heading into the fun half now. See you guys there.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back. Back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just wanna degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back, back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare.
Bring back DJ Denner.
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Denner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
You see, white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males are psych.
Fuck them. Fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay, I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
Lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, 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 back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them. Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black,
black Africans are back, back.
Come on. What? Come on. What? Come on. Really? Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.